Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Drs. Julie and Keith and Len Leche, UNCW professors of psychology and co-founders of the Mars Memory Health Network. We're talking about age-related dementia and Alzheimer's. If you have a question for our guests today, or if you have an experience with Alzheimer's you'd like to share, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using coastline. HQR. We haven't yet talked really about what Mars does and why the two of you are both enthusiastic proponents of screening, even before some of these signs, these obvious signs of Alzheimer's start to show up. Why would someone want to get screened early, Len Leche?
Well, the why part, what's critical here is, as Julie mentioned a little earlier in the show, is that our goal was to help identify people long before we're at the stage where family members can identify this individual as having memory, you know, severe memory loss, advanced dementia. And the key for that is really because the best, you know, interventions that are out there are really ones that, prevention by delay, essentially. They're not cures. We don't have a cure for it. And so for that reason, getting to someone very early in the process is absolutely critical. And so it makes sense if you think about it really from the standpoint of any other health condition, whether it be monitoring your blood pressure, prostate PSA levels, and mammograms, anything like this. Really, the common sense approach is when you start hitting in the risk, and remember, the number one risk for dementia of the Alzheimer's type is age. You know, we often focus on these other factors, but it's really age. This is not a disease of 10 or 20 or 30-year-olds, really. It's by and large a disease that its incidence increases dramatically when we start getting 60 and up. And so what makes sense is as we start approaching those high-risk ages is that we begin thinking about that sort of routine, what we like to call the checkup from the neck up, right, the memory checkup. And so when you do this in a way that's proactive, that you're not waiting for the profound symptoms and your family to bring you in, but rather that you think about this is something that just makes sense for me to kind of monitor, get a baseline, get a sense of where I'm functioning, and that baseline then provides us more information in order to compare scores down the road. And again, the rationale being we can catch this early. Earlier we catch it, the earlier we can intervene. And the earlier we intervene, the more we can forestall the onset of the more severe symptoms down the road.
Julie and Keith, you were talking during the break. You said there are some drugs that are currently out there, not used for treating Alzheimer's, but other drugs that people take that may contribute to Alzheimer's risk. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. There are two recent studies. There were very well-done studies, very, very carefully conducted, that showed that some of the most commonly used medications, medications for treating anxiety, like Ativan, Xanax, Valium, even Lunesta for sleep disorders and so forth, and a class of drugs called the anticholinesterases, which can include antihistamines, so drugs like Benadryl. Drugs that are taken for headaches, particularly migraines, can double your chances of developing Alzheimer's, even if you're using them only at the minimally effective dose for a period of about 3 years. So you don't want people to run out and quit taking medications their doctor has prescribed because, you know, this needs to be done under doctor supervision. But knowing that these drugs double your chances of developing Alzheimer's is a major flag that we should pay attention to. So, you know, people take Benadryl to help them sleep sometimes. When I read the study, I actually passed it along to people that I knew would take Benadryl just as a sleep aid. Because it will. It'll knock you out at night. You take a half of Benadryl and you're down for the evening. But it turns out that doing that chronically over the period of about 3 years, even at a minimal dose, doubles your risk of developing Alzheimer's.
You're listening to Coastline. It's going to take me a minute to process that. That's a staggering notion that you're not talking about increasing your risk 10 or 20%, but you're doubling your risk. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease, what the risk factors are, why some experts recommend early screening, and what new breakthroughs could be on the horizon. In the studio to answer your questions are Dr. Julian Keith and Dr. Len Leche. Both men are founders of Mars Memory Health Network in Wilmington. They're also both professors of psychology at UNCW. Angelo from Southport, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you. Excuse my hoarseness. I went to the Mars Memory Group in Wilmington and went through some tests because I started to feel that I was losing some memory. And eventually it led me to take a couple of sleep tests, and I was diagnosed with sleep apnea, which they indicated was one of the causes of my memory loss. I'm now using a CPAP and taking preventive measures. However, will sleep apnea contribute to one getting Alzheimer's? That's my question. I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Len Leche.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you, Angela, for the call, and thank you. What's really important also about this call, before I directly answer Angela's question, is that many times when people come in that are suffering memory difficulties, the cause of those, there are many other much more likely causes as well. So this is a great example of a case where someone comes in and might document some problem, but there are other very likely culprits. I mentioned depression earlier. Sleep apnea is certainly another one. And so to hear that this individual is correctly diagnosed and then we've sort of moved on with that treatment and it's addressing that problem, that's great. His question, though, is still important. So sleep apnea is a risk factor for dementia, the Alzheimer's type. However, by treating it effectively and getting on the CPAP, he actually brings his risk factors down to almost where they would be if he did not have it. So effective treatment and certainly knowing about CPAP, it's a real dedicated effort on individuals, you know, to continue to use the device to provide the continuous oxygen while they're sleeping. But if he is diligent about treating it, then actually his risk increase is only minimal when he is engaged in that treatment. But untreated, unfortunately, sleep apnea does increase your risk.
We were talking earlier about the exponentially increasing costs associated with the treatment of Alzheimer's disease and the increasing sector of the population that is grappling with this. Does insurance cover a screening for someone who is not showing signs of the disease?
That's a wonderful question. The way the insurance system is set up is that if there is a referral diagnosis from a primary care doctor, then it is covered by insurance. So, for example, the typical individual might have Medicare and a secondary. That would fully cover the cost of the evaluation. But there would need to be a referring diagnosis, which means the primary care physician, you know, has some suspicion of whether it's memory loss or something of that nature. With that, then it would be fully covered. If there really is no – so you have an individual who's completely healthy. They'd just like to establish a baseline. They have no memory risk factors, et cetera. Then that would not be covered by insurance. I will say our facility, when we first opened – we established a baseline assessment to specifically target individuals who are in that latter category who might not have any of the signs that would trigger a normal referral process, but to really allow them to be tested at a pretty cost-effective rate. And so we do offer these baseline assessments for individuals so they're non-insurance referred. The other nice piece about them is, you know, you mentioned earlier the caller talking about the long-term healthcare insurance. This would kind of stay off the radar of long-term healthcare because it's not activated in the insurance. As soon as a doctor makes a referral, of course, that is part of your official record. If you decide to come in on your own and establish a baseline, that's your own private evaluation that you would be doing. So there's sort of another added feature of that approach.
Now, we've touched on earlier a little bit the genetic nature of this, and you do not do genetic screening at Mars Memory Health Network, and there are arguments both for and against getting screened to find out if it's part of your hereditary structure. So why would someone want to get screened for that genetically?
Well, there's ethical aspects to that question. And, you know, some people like to be fully informed. The thing to remember with genetic testing is, in essence, it's giving you a probability. It is not a guarantee that you – so you could test clean in terms of the genetics and you would have potentially still develop dementia of the Alzheimer's type. It would be a, what they often refer to as sporadic, non-familial version of it. You can also have the most significant risk factors genetically and never manifest the disease. So what's important really as people take a test like that is to remember that it's really giving you information on how likely you are, but not giving you information on whether you will functionally have those symptoms down the road. And so it's correct. We don't do that part. We do the functional assessment component. So,
and, Julian, and with the sporadic incident. So sporadic Alzheimer's are cases where there's not a known genetic component. But the majority of cases are sporadic. So if you screened and didn't have any of the known genetic markers, you still have a risk of developing Alzheimer's.
So are you saying, Julian Keith, that most people who suffer from Alzheimer's are not suffering from it because of their genetics?
But they're not suffering from it because of known genetic markers.
Okay.
So there may be genes that are determinants of their risk that we don't know of yet. So at this point, though, most cases don't have the known genetic markers. So that raises the question when you go in for a genetic screen, how much information are you actually getting? You haven't narrowed things down too much. If you've narrowed the probability a small amount, but you really don't have a lot of new information if you don't test as having the known markers.
Len Leyte, you've talked about recent study results. Scientists replicated Alzheimer's in a petri dish, and you say this might even qualify as Nobel Prize-winning work. Why is that so significant?
Well, so this happened up in Massachusetts that they were able to essentially recreate the plaques tangles essentially in a petri dish. And one of the reasons this is a huge advancement is it allows for the very rapid testing of compounds. There's a large number of compounds that are sort of in the queue for possible drug testing down the road. But in order to sort of get to the level of human testing, which is sort of the ultimate last stage, they have to go through a series of preliminary steps and animal testing, and that can take several years to go through that. So we're really talking about an accelerated timeline now to where individuals can evaluate the effectiveness of various compounds and see the effects right, you know, in the petri dish. And so what this is likely to do is cut significantly the time to trials, essentially some more successful trials, most likely eliminating a large number of compounds and hopefully giving us a better sense of what those important compounds are. I think the implications of that work will come in the, you know, in the years to come.
When we're looking at what's out there to treat Alzheimer's right now, what do we have? And are there any drugs that are pretty effective?
There are two classes of drugs that are used to treat Alzheimer's now. One has been around for quite a long time. They're anticholinesterase drugs. They essentially keep the neurotransmitter acetylcholine at higher levels in the brain. Loss of cholinergic neurons, we call them, the neurons that manufacture and release acetylcholine, is one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. So elevating acetylcholine that's available in the brain of a person with Alzheimer's can improve functioning. There's another class of drugs that works very differently. This is going to be a hard one for your listeners to remember. They're called N-methyldiaspartate receptor antagonists. And there's one of these that's a very low potency one that seems to work by reducing the excitability of cells. And one hypothesis about why Alzheimer's develops is that certain cells shift in their excitability profiles. They can become too excited. They overload with calcium, and then they go into this death spiral. So if you can block the calcium channels with these N-methyldiaspartate receptor antagonists that will help keep more calcium channels closed, you protect the brain from going through that death spiral with these cells. So if you use these drugs together, cholinesterase inhibitors with these NMDA receptor antagonists, you seem to get better effects than if you use either one alone.
Len Leachy.
And I think another way to think about this, especially in the light of some of the studies that have come out in the last few years, is almost to think about this as tiers of treatment. So the sort of tier one level of treatment, it's really the sort of thing probably all of us should be doing. But as you have more risk factors, you may want to think about them even more. And that's some of the dietary and lifestyle changes we discussed earlier in the show. And then, of course, as you move to the level of, all right, we are looking at sort of the earliest stages of the disease, what we often call mild cognitive impairment, the amnestic version of that. And then the very early stages of Alzheimer's, then the introduction of some of these medications makes a lot of sense as well. So sort of a two-level treatment, one that really we should all be doing and hopefully would be in a very early stages for individuals who are going down the path. And then these secondary ones that would come on board, as Julie mentioned, usually starting with the cholinesterase inhibitors and then moving on and adding the cognitive neuroprotectors.
So just to be clear, we're talking about lifestyle changes, possibly preventive factors when it comes to the disease. And we just have a minute left. But what are the three most important things that people can do to stave off their risk of age-related dementia? Julie and Keith.
Eat a Mediterranean-style diet. Reduce the amount of meat that you're eating. Reduce carbohydrates. Eat more plant-based. Exercise. And learn to relax. Of course, that makes people stressed out when you tell them you need to relax, but learn to relax.
Good advice. Thank you both so much. That's this edition of Coastline, and I'd like to thank our guests, Drs. Len Leachy and Julian Keith of UNCW and Mars Memory Health Network. Thanks also to you, our listeners, those of you who called and emailed. Join us for the next Coastline. We're examining foster care and foster parenting in the Cape Fear region. That's next Wednesday at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.